Dr. Lester? Thank you, Dr. Lester. Mrs. Peterson, Secretary of Works, ladies and gentlemen. It is a great pleasure for me to come before this group this morning, and I dare say the only group which can frankly and candidly and without fear of any criticism admit that the only subject on its mind is girls. When Ms. Peterson called on me right after our inauguration to tell me about the organization of this commission, I told her that she could just mark me down as a sympathizer and as an outspoken ally. In my own household, I am outnumbered 3-1, and having been in political life for some 25 years now, I learned a long time ago that you always bow to this kind of minority. I've watched with interest and admiration the things that this commission has done, and I want to congratulate the members for wasting no time in getting started on a solid and in a purposeful way. No problems can be licked and no great progress can be made by Washington alone. So that is why you're here today, and we appreciate your taking the time and the expense to come and reason with us. I consider the work of this commission to really be trailblazing. We've spent so many years ignoring the reality that it's difficult even to find elementary facts and figures. For the first time, you are now assembling them in a purposeful manner that can and should lead to purposeful action. Certainly no one more clearly exemplifies the capabilities and the pioneering spirit of the great American woman than does the chairman of this commission, the revered and beloved Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt. She has been called the First Lady of the World, and her leadership of this commission offers a guiding light everywhere. When I first took the assignment as chairman of the President's Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, I was talking with some of my friends one evening, and we observed that if we could have a commission to prevent discrimination in employment because of race, why shouldn't we do something about discrimination in employment because of sex? And I don't know how word got to the Secretary of Labor and the Assistant Secretary of Labor that night, but the next morning I found they were forming a commission. And I know that you welcome, as I do, to your membership, the very distinguished and able Secretary of Labor, for whom we all have such great regard and respect, Mr. Secretary Wirtz. We also approach with some sadness the fact that another man who would have been here this morning and perhaps would have been talking to you just happened somehow or other to wind up with another appointment that happens to be on the Supreme Court and makes his presence here impossible. But I do know that all of you feel a debt of gratitude for the leadership and for the vision and for the humanitarian instincts displayed by what I consider one of the great men of our time, the former Secretary of Labor, and the man who has been nominated to be Associate Justice Supreme Court, Mr. Arthur Goldberg. If all of our problems were due solely to evil men and evil women, a solution would be simple. But good people in this world outnumber bad people overwhelmingly, and we all know that. But unfortunately, most of our problems do not come because people are good or bad, but they arise out of ignorance and desire to avoid change even when the world around us is changing at a very rapid rate. I think this is what's happening in terms of the problem that you're concerned about, equal opportunity for women. One of the major revolutions of the 20th century has been a revolution in the pattern of living of our women. In our grandmother's day, the average working age of the career girl was 26. Today, it is 40. Between these two figures lies a fantastic change in the whole fabric of American society. Modern technology has created new patterns of production which rely much more upon brains and nimbleness than upon brawn and endurance. At the same time, the traditional arts and crafts which made the housewife of half a century ago a skilled technician, a dishwasher, a seamstress, a nurse, a laundress, a baker, often even a teacher, have today disappeared. This means that we have a far greater market for brains and ability in the world of economic production, and we also have at the same time created the supply to fill that demand. But somehow we failed to bring the two together. Our productive system that needs more brains and needs more skills, and the women who have the brains and who have the skills that are needed to fill that supply. It is a mistake to think that this is a question of viciousness or prejudice, even though many men long nostalgically for the grandmother who could do everything from sewing up a rip in his trousers to teaching him how to read and write. The real cause is that we have not faced up to the changes that have taken place in our lifetime. I have a daughter who just entered college this morning. It does not take a crystal ball to forecast the probable course of her life. She will graduate from college out into the labor market. Somewhere along the line, she will probably decide that there is something to life other than an office. Like most women, she will be in and out of the economic process. But according to the experts, she'll have a life expectancy of 70 years. And no matter how she manages her life, she'll probably have more time to devote to the economic process than to simply stay at home and take care of a family. She will need to know not only how to be a good homemaker, but perhaps at some time how to be a good breadwinner at all times and be a participating member of society throughout her life. Children do grow up. Children do leave home as inevitably as summer follows the spring and fall follows the summer. Therefore, it will be important to my daughter and to all of our daughters that she have an opportunity to make use of whatever skills she has learned, and is equally important to our society that it have the opportunity to make use of her skills. Somehow, some way, we must find a method by which this talent may not be lost or grow stale. If we have enough brains to send a sophisticated communication system hurtling within 10,000 miles of Venice, surely we have the brains to organize a society in such a way that this talent will not be wasted. I think we have to consider a simple matter of justice. No governmental or social program will ever succeed that leaves justice out of its consideration. One of the oldest injunctions of the wise man is that the laborer is worthy of his hire. I, for one, am weary of systems which differentiate between compensation for work well done for any reason other than merit. We live in a never-never land if we believe that this is still a society in which women who work are merely supplementing income from male relatives. The reality of our society today is that we need the productive talents of every single person. We must abolish discrimination because of race, creed, color, or national origin. We must retrain those workers who have been caught in the back eddies of technological unemployment. We must find ways and means of using our people of middle age who have many productive years ahead of them. And we must find forms of social and economic organization that will eliminate sex as a barrier to the fulfillment of talent and capacity. To solve this problem of discrimination because of sex is going to require a great many adjustments and changes. But they are adjustments and changes that must be made because they will enhance the prosperity and because they will protect the security of our country. We must realize that few women will spend their entire adult lifetime behind a desk or in a laboratory or on a production line, but it is worth some time and some effort to take advantage of the many years of work that are open to us. And let us be unmistakably clear. Equal employment opportunity is not a luxury in which we indulge out of a fuzzy-headed motive. It has become not only a question of justice, which alone should be enough, but it is a question of grim and urgent necessity. Some time ago, I made a very careful and painstaking survey of space installations on the West Coast. I visited the great universities where the basic research is now being performed. I visited the factories where they're making the rockets and the payloads. I visited the centers where the cool, clear-eyed test pilots are making the first tentative thrusts outside of the atmospheric envelope around the Earth. Everywhere, I heard the same story. We need more brains. Right now, it is a question of competition between the government and private industry for the physicists, for the biologists, for the mathematicians, for the astrophysicists, for the metallurgists, and the system managers. But I talked to some men who speculated convincingly that within a 3 or 4 year period, we would have to start rationing brains just as we rationed coffee during World War II. The only difference is that if we had run out of coffee, many people would have been uncomfortable. But if we run out of brains, the whole world may lose its freedom. I don't believe that we're at the stage where we must ration brains. I think before we reach that stage, there are resources that we have not tapped, but which should be tapped. As chairman of the President's Committee on Equal Employment Opportunities, I am trying to tap those resources which have not been used for reasons of ancestry irrelevant to merit. There is a Senate committee which now is attempting to find means of tapping resources which are now denied to us because of unrealistic considerations of age. We have passed the Manpower Retraining and Development Act, which is now attempting to do something about those who have been fired by machine, maybe not be close to us because of outmoded customs and habits. There's one other point that I would like to make. The slogan, equality of opportunity, can no longer and will no longer serve as a mask for social injustice. We're past that stage of history. Anatole France once said that the law in its equal majesty forbids both the rich and the poor to sleep under bridges. Similarly, there was a time when equality of opportunity meant the right to exploit women by working them 16 to 18 hours a day in sweatshops at substandard wages. Well, I do not engage in any idle speculation when I tell you that we are not going to return to those times. That is not involved in the work in which you are doing. What we are seeking is justice and prosperity. And this can only be found through assuring opportunity to all of our people. I'm not going to say that a woman can do a better job than a man, except for motherhood, just because she is a woman, any more than I'm going to say that a man can do a better job than a woman, except for fatherhood, because he is a man. But I am going to say that everyone should have the opportunity to compete for a job on the sole basis of merit. And when that is our single test, we can be certain of the survival of our way of life. This has become apparent not only to us, but to the people all over the world. The Shah of Iran did not walk his wife and his female relatives through the streets of Iran without veils because he thought this would be a clever innovation. He did it to tell his people that they should begin removing the veil from the vote so women could become active in the life of their country. President Ataturk did not invoke the vote and compulsory education for women in Turkey out of a personal whim. He did so because he realized that women were sorely needed for Turkey to gain its true place in the sun. Throughout the Middle East, I found women play an increasing role in national life. And yet, this is the area of the world where traditionally women have been at the very bottom of the ladder. One of the byproducts which the free world is inheriting from this progress of women in the Middle East is the impetus that they have given to social reform in their own countries. This is crucial in that part of the world that sits on the rim of the Soviet Union. One of the most important weapons that we have in the Cold War struggle is the continuing evidence that social reform is more of a reality on our side of the Iron Curtain. But above all, in the world in which we live, we're engaged in a struggle to demonstrate which way of life affords the best hope and the best promise for the individual human being. To the individual, the most important thing is fulfillment. Fulfillment of his or her capacity to serve. In all that we do, we're going to face a very harsh judge, the judge of history. We shall be known for our ability to bring the greatest good to the greatest number. We shall be judged for our capacity to adjust ourselves to the changing facts of the world and to the changing circumstances of history. I do not think that you have come here today to devise ways and means for extending special privilege or for creating new special interests. I do think that you've come here to help us solve a problem which presents an injustice and with a disruptive force in our national life. You have excellent leadership. You have dedicated workers. You have the complete and absolute backing of the great leader of our country, President John F. Kennedy, and all the administration that he represents. I wish you every success, and I am ready to help you whenever I can. And after traveling in 6 countries, 3 of which are there on the rim of the Iron Curtain, and seeing men who have left their homes to defend freedom, and who serve in an army for $1.80 a month, and to see the adult population of all of those countries who know very little about the Vice President of America and who he may be. But when they see that flag flying from the fender of a car, they dash out into the streets and stop the automobile. 4 hours it took us to go from the airport in Ankara to the hotel, from 4 in the afternoon to 8 at night. We had to stop and address the multitude 17 times. Now there is a reason for that, just as there was a reason for 2 priests to stop our car that was speeding down the streets of Naples, with 200 or 300 little school children following them out into the middle of the street to face the traffic that was coming down the hill. The priest stopped and said, "We just must take this opportunity." We learned that the spokesman and representative of the United States was here. "We must just tell you that never in all recorded history have the victors treated the vanquished as the United States has treated the rest of the world. In 17 years since the end of World War II, you have supplied assistance and a helping hand to lift up the people of more than 100 countries. And you have done it wisely without a promise of material gain and at great sacrifice and expense of your own people. But you have made this a different world. You have kept this a peaceful world. And we want you to know here in Italy that now that you see the vitality you do in our economy, that we are not only thankful to you for what you have done for us, but we're going to show that gratitude by joining with you and helping others to to help themselves. That humanitarianism, that feeling for people, that desire to do unto others as you would have them do unto you, is born in a woman's breast. And I say to those of you who are joining us in this pioneer work, to make these steps upward, to go on up the road to help us meet this great deficiency of brains that the world is yearning for and needs so much today, I say congratulations to you. I thank you for the contribution you've made. I look forward with great expectancy to the fruits of your labors. And I assure you that whenever we here in government can help, that President Kennedy wants us all to keep our shoulder to the wheel. Thank you.